Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us early this morning. My name is Sam Pollock. For those of you who I don't know, I'm the CEO of Brookfield Infrastructure Partners, and we appreciate you joining us for the second part of the Brookfield Company Investor Day. The day's agenda is going to start with a presentation by my team in Brookfield Infrastructure Partners. Presentation will last about 2 hours, and then, assuming we're all on schedule, we're going to take about a 15-minute break, and then Sachin and his team are going to come up and present Brookfield Renewable Energy Partners. We hope you can join us for both presentations. So we'll move on to the Brookfield Infrastructure portion of the day. And as most of you know, we remain one of the largest globally diversified infrastructure companies in the world, with a market capitalization of around $9 billion. And our business is fairly well diversified across sectors and geographies. And this year we've added a fourth segment in the communications infrastructure segment. For the presentation today, our plan was to follow the same format as last year. And this is where a few of us will come up and focus on a few attributes of the company which we think differentiate ourselves from others. Now, before we get into the actual presentation itself, what I thought I would do is review how we've done over the past year. So I have to say that we're generally pleased with the performance over the past 12 months. We've added new businesses and delivered solid results. Our FFO for the year was up 6%, but the result is somewhat muted by currency headwinds that we faced and the timing around transactions and equity raisings. As an example, the same-store FFO per unit growth of the business was up 11% on a constant currency basis. And if we'd done our April equity issue just at the end of the quarter instead of at the beginning of the quarter, our Q2 run rate on a constant unit basis would have been up about 16% over the prior year. So, in fact, the underlying businesses have been doing quite well. Also, on a positive note, we're going into the fourth quarter with about $3 billion liquidity, which puts us in a great position to close on the announced transactions that we have in front of us. I know one of the things that is near and dear to everyone's heart is our distributions. And on the back of the good results and our investment in TDF, last February we increased our distributions by about 10%. We've now extended our track record of distribution growth to 6 consecutive years. And I know the share price is something that is also pretty important. While we've trailed off a little bit over the last number of months, if we hit a high of about $46 early in the year, and we've traded down to about $39 today. And while we're disappointed with, obviously, that pullback, a lot of that is in response to market conditions. But I think if we can continue to deliver the distribution growth that we have in the past, you know, we'll see that recover and get back up to those levels. At last year's Investor Day, we covered 4 topics, and we thought it'd be worthwhile just to give you an update on how we fared in each of those areas, because in essence, they were some of our priorities. The first section we covered was a presentation by Ben Vaughan, who's our Chief Operating Officer, and he discussed the quality of our assets, and he did a bit of a case study on our utilities business. You'll recall that we were pretty excited about why we thought our businesses were strong and performing well, but we thought it would have been useful to show an analysis of why we felt they were undervalued compared to analyst consensus. At the time, you know, we put a presentation that showed that the we felt the assets were worth about $28 per unit compared to about $19 per unit from the analyst. And I'd say our view of those assets hasn't changed, and we remain very positive about their value. In 2015, those assets continued to produce solid and stable cash flows. We added about $200 million into our rate base in the various assets, and we replenished our capital backlog by about $350 million into new projects. Lastly, we sold a stake in our New England transmission business at a very attractive valuation. We were able to sell an asset at about 16 times EBITDA multiple, and that's higher than most comparable transactions in the sector. This is a business that, even though it had very little growth and was probably the main reason why we decided to sell it, it was still deemed as a very attractive asset to institutional investors because they coveted its bond-like income stream. Next, here, Manuel, our Chief Financial Officer, explained the importance of our organic growth engine to the business. As he described in his remarks, we generally expect to achieve internally generated growth in FFO of 8 to 10% per annum. Our long-term view of those growth rates hasn't changed. And on a constant currency same-store basis, we're on track to achieve about 11% FFO growth in 2015. We then had one of our colleagues, Alfredo Zamirego, he's one of our managing partners in Europe, describe our business development efforts, and he gave a bit of a spotlight on the many opportunities that we saw in Europe. Shortly after Investor Day, we announced our first transaction in the communications infrastructure sector, and this is where we invested about $415 million into a leading communications infrastructure business in France. It's a business called TDF. And we closed the transaction at the end of the first quarter of this year. This is a business that we like a lot. It's got very strong cash flow generating capabilities, and it operates in a sector where we see many opportunities to grow the business. We bought the business in a bilateral negotiation at about a 10 times EBITDA multiple, which we think is great value for that sector. And while still early days, so far the results of the business has been excellent. The business generated about a 19% FFO yield in the second quarter of this year, so it's doing quite well already. And then the final part of our presentation last year touched on the benefits of capital recycling as an element of our business strategy. At a high level, we generally consider selling assets when we think they have maxed out from a growth perspective, or we think there's very little growth opportunities left in the business, or if we feel we can achieve an opportunistic pricing scenario. Back in 2012 and 13, we sold five assets generating proceeds of approximately $1.5 billion. This year, we started a new phase of capital recycling, beginning with the sale of the New England transmission business that I spoke about a few minutes ago. We also initiated a strategic review of our natural gas pipeline business, NGPL. And I'll say from an operating perspective, we're pleased that that business has started to turn a corner, and we're seeing some positive green shoots from an earnings perspective. And hopefully later this year, probably in later this fourth quarter, we'll be able to disclose the results of that strategic review. We also identified two additional assets for sale. And I know probably the first question, I'm not sure which analysts will do it, but they'll ask what companies are we looking to sell. But I can't tell you at this stage what those two assets are, as we're not disclosing that. But what I can tell you is that we believe we'll generate about $300 million in net proceeds from those two asset sales in 2016. So with that, it's just a warm-up to today's session. I'll run through the rest of the day's agenda. So first up will be Stuart Upson, who's going to talk about some of our high-quality assets with a particular focus on the port and rail business. And he's also going to touch on our pending acquisition of Asciano and just how that fits into our business. Next, Marcos Almeida, our managing partner in Brazil, is going to focus on global business development. And he's going to do a spotlight on Brazil and the many opportunities that we see there today. Third, Bahir Manios, our Chief Financial Officer, will come up, and he's going to provide a review of our financial profile with a particular focus on some of the issues that people are concerned today, namely interest rates and foreign currency, and just how, you know, in spite of that volatility, we still have secure and stable cash flows. And lastly, I'll come back up and talk about our diversification strategy and how that fits into our approach to building value. Just from a format perspective, we are going to take questions at the end of each section. So after Stuart comes up, you can ask him some questions. But we're probably limited to about three after each person. And then at the end, I'm happy to come back up after my section and answer any other questions that are that people may have. So with that, I'll now turn it over to Stuart.
Thanks, Sam, and good morning, everyone. So we own a diverse portfolio of attractive assets across four continents, and you can see on the slide where our operations are located. Our business includes assets in all of the mainstream categories of infrastructure: ports, railroads, utilities, toll roads, natural gas distribution, and now telecom towers. But today I'm going to focus on our port and rail transportation platform. First, I'm going to spend some time refreshing everyone on the high-quality assets that we own today. And then I'm going to take you through the two fantastic businesses that we're going to add to our portfolio as a result of the Asciano transaction, which we think is going to be a real game-changer for our port and rail transportation business. The two key components underlying our port and rail strategy, value and growth, I'm going to spend some time explaining how we think the market would value the existing world-class operations that we have today. And I'm also going to lay out the roadmap for how we plan to build out and globalize our port and rail platform going forward. So today we already have a diversified portfolio of high-quality port and rail assets. On the port side, we have 30 bulk and container terminals. We've got one landlord port. We move more than 80 million tons of bulk product annually and more than 2 million TEUs of containers. We've got assets located in the US, Brazil, UK, and Europe. In the rail business, we've got 10,000 kilometres of track, around 700 locomotives, 17,000 wagons, and six rail loading terminals. We move more than 54 billion NTKs of product annually, and our assets are located in Australia and Brazil. So our existing assets have very attractive investment attributes. They tend to have long-term cash flows with consistent through-the-cycle earnings growth. As I mentioned, they're located in attractive economic environments. They tend to be market leaders in their respective segments with solid blue-chip customer base across shipping lines, agriculture, and mining sectors. And they have fantastic growth franchises. We've already invested over $550 million in growth capital into these sectors since 2012. And we've got a really strong future pipeline, and I'm going to touch on a few of those projects shortly. So this slide just gives you a feel for where our existing port assets are located. They're diversified by both type and location. If you look at the map, you can see on the west coast of the US, we have our container terminals. In the UK, we have our landlord port. And then spread throughout Europe and Brazil, we've got a series of bulk terminal assets. On our rail assets, two businesses. On the left, we've got our fully integrated Brazilian rail business. It includes below rail, above rail, inland terminals and ports, which have some major expansions underway and some huge growth potential. On the right, we've got Australia, which is our below rail business, and it's got a very strong franchise, and we expect that's going to continue to grow steadily with the Australian economy over time. So now I want to highlight some of the great growth projects we have underway. First, in our container terminals, we're partway through an automation project at at our container terminal in Los Angeles. We expect it's going to cost around $200 million, and it will double our terminal capacity from 1.1 million to 2.2 million TEUs. Once complete, our LA terminal is going to be the first fully automated container terminal on the west coast of the US. It's also going to be the lowest cost terminal in the Port of Los Angeles, which is going to provide us with a cost advantage we estimate somewhere around 30% over our nearest competitor, and that should be a significant competitive advantage to help us capture some growth going forward. The automation project's in phase 2 of 5, and we expect it's going to complete by early 2018. So now I'm going to try and run a little video showing the current status of the terminal so you can see how the automation works. When you watch the video, one thing you're going to see is you won't see any people, and what you need to appreciate is that none of the equipment you see moving around is directly controlled by a person either. It's all run off a system-wide algorithm that autonomously works out the most efficient way to move containers from point to point. Okay, so I'll run the video now. When it finishes, I'll be back to talk a little more about it. Okay, so I think a few people got that beer, probably laughed more than anyone, but that was the that was indeed the theme song to Terminator 2. Every time I see this technology in action, I just can't help but think we're that one step closer to the machines rising up and taking over. But, you know, other than that small issue, it's a really exciting project, and we think the technology is seriously amazing. So you will have seen in the video the driverless autostrads moving containers between the ships and the auto-stacking cranes, which then enable us to maximize the stockyard capacity and stack the boxes 5 high. And that all happens, as I said, without any human interaction. We're really excited about this project, and it's going to add a lot of value to our business over the next few years. So now moving on to our business in Brazil, we've got a number of exciting growth projects underway in that integrated port and rail business. I'm going to highlight the expansion of one of our bulk ports. This investment is to expand the Tipland terminal at the Port of Santos. It's a 2.2 billion rei project. And if you have a look on the slide at the top picture, that's kind of what the port looks like, you know, pre-expansion, currently only one berth, and that berth is used to import various fertilizer products. The second picture shows that the expansion is going to add 3 berths, increase the stockyard area, add a new rail loop, which is going to enable efficient loading and unloading of products. Once the expansion is complete, in addition to the importing of fertilizers, the port's also going to export grains and sugars that originate at our inland receivable terminals and then come down our rail line to the port. The expansion is going to materially increase capacity of the port from about 2.5 million tonnes per annum to 15.8 million. And it's around 55% progress right now. We expect it's going to complete in late 2017. Okay, so we have some great port assets and some exciting growth projects, but, you know, what do we think our port assets are worth? We've had a look at the recent multiples for port transactions over the past few years, and we've found that they've ranged from 14 to 27 times EBITDA, so it's a very wide range. That large spread is really driven by the nature of the assets, with landlord ports commanding the largest multiples. They've got protected franchises, low maintenance capex, and linked to economic growth. Container and bulk terminals tend to be at the lower end of the range, as they tend to be more competitive and capital heavy. But they still get pretty good multiples because you know, they do have the same economic growth linkage. So given the very different valuation multiples that get applied to the different kinds of port assets, and we think it makes sense to think about our port business based on its component parts. So, you know, as you can see in the chart here, what we've done is split our port EBITDA into container, bulk, and landlord conservancy income and applied the multiple ranges that we believe would be achieved if we took these assets to market. So for our container terminals, as I just explained, we're in the process of completing that major automation project in LA. We expect that's going to double our container terminal income in the next 3 years. And so we did the math to adjust a steady-state container terminal business multiple around 14 to 16 times in a few years when that step change growth has occurred and brought it back to today. And we get to a multiple range of around 20 to 25 times EBITDA today on the current in-place income. And for our bulk terminals, we've applied a pretty conservative range of 11 to 13 times, which is below where the comps are coming out, but mainly that's because the assets are mostly located in Europe, where there's still a few economic headwinds in the short term. For the landlord port conservancy income, we've applied a range of 16 to 20 times EBITDA, which again, you know, feels pretty conservative to us given the multiples that have been paid in the market for those sort of high-quality assets. Altogether, we get to a blended multiple range of 14.4 times to 17.6 times, an enterprise value range of 1.2 to 1.5 billion for our ports, which, you know, we think is pretty conservative given the high-quality nature of the assets and the embedded organic growth potential we've got there. So just turning to our rail assets, it's a little bit harder on this side of things. You know, we did a lot of thinking about how our rail assets would be valued in the market, and we came to the conclusion that there's actually really aren't any very good comps for our two rail businesses. In Brazil, we've got this amazing integrated rail business that's partway through a four-year, 6 billion rei expansion project. The project involves replenishing rolling stock, upgrading sections of the track, building a series of inland receival terminals, and also that major Tipland bulk port project that I mentioned. We're investing the capital on the basis of a forecast 2.6 times EBITDA multiple, so we expect there's going to be some step change growth in income and in values over time, over the next, say, 3 to 5 years. And we're targeting investing that capital at a 20% return, but also all of the capital we invest in that business has the benefit of a minimum return guarantee, so our downside is limited. Taking all that into account, we think that our position in this business would attract a pretty large valuation multiple. Turning to our below rail business in Australia, again, it's hard to compare because most of the comps are integrated businesses and they tend to have more market risk and shorter-term contracts than our business. Taking a step back and thinking about, you know, what is our Australian rail business most like, it's actually got most in common with a landlord port. It's got a legislative franchise area. It's got long-term contracts that are linked to inflation. And over the long term, it will tend to grow with the Australian economy. And so, you know, again, for those reasons, we expect that our below rail business in Australia would trade at a higher multiple than traditional integrated North American businesses. So we dug out some comps anyway. Rail transactions are few and far between, and this table actually takes us all the way back to 2009. We've also put some of the trading comps on there. The range comes out at around 8 to 11 times, but as I just explained, it's not, we don't find it particularly helpful in working out our math. So turning to, you know, what does that mean in terms of what our rail businesses are worth? For our above rail business in Brazil, we forecast out, again, based on its business plan to where we get to a steady state and expansion's complete. We've PV'd that back to today and worked it out what the multiple would be on today's income. And we get to a range of around 16 to 20 times EBITDA. And it feels pretty sensible given that EBITDA in this business is expected to triple in the next 5 years. For our below rail business, again, we've run a simple forecast based on how we think institutional investors would look at, you know, a low-risk business of this nature and arrived at a valuation range of 12.5 to 13.5 times EBITDA. So altogether, we get a multiple range of 13.2 to 14.8 times and enterprise value range of 4.1 to 4.6 billion for the rail business, and you know, we think that's a pretty appropriate outcome given the material growth in the above rail business and the highly sought after franchise nature of the below rail business. So pulling it all together, we estimate a net asset value to BIP of approximately 4.3 billion for our existing port and rail assets. That number is based on the midpoint of those two valuation ranges I just took you through. And when compared to street consensus NAV valuations, it implies around a $4 unit uplift for our port and rail business. Okay, so hopefully now you've got a pretty good understanding of the embedded value of our existing assets. I wanted to spend some time focusing on the future. So on August 17, we announced that we'd agreed to buy 100% of Asciano for an enterprise value of Australian $12 billion. ASEAN is a publicly traded Australian transportation infrastructure company. It's got two key components. First, Pacific National. It's a business with nationwide above-rail haulage operations consisting of 664 locomotives and over 14,000 wagons, which have the capacity to haul 180 million tonnes of freight. It's diversified across mineral and bulk haulage and steel and intermodal services. In the Patrick Port business, there's four high-quality container terminals in major Australian cities, including Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Perth, They've got a capacity of around 4.9 million TEUs, and they're using around 3.2 to 3.3 million of those right now. So there's significant surplus capacity for high margin expansion. Also in Patrick, they've got a port terminal and supply chain services business that supports shipping lines, importers, exporters, freight forwarders and customs brokers in approximately 40 ports around Australia and New Zealand. So Asciano is Australia's leading port and rail business, and we think it will be a game changer when combined with the high-quality assets we already have in Brookfield Infrastructure. This business has strong positions in all its key markets. It's one of only two participants in the haulage of coal. It's a clear market leader for intermodal freight with more than 70% market share in that sector. It's also one of only two parties that has container terminal operations in the four key capital city ports, which gives it a competitive advantage when it's competing for customers in the market. It has a unique network of rail assets with the largest fleet of rolling stock in Australia and 11 strategically located inland intermodal terminals, key capital cities and in regional centres that support that intermodal rail business. A really important point, the business has just completed a five-year, $3.3 billion capex program. It's overhauled its fleet, it's upgraded its intermodal terminals and its maintenance facilities, and really importantly, it's automated its Sydney container terminal, similar to what we just saw with our LA terminal, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. Its business is underpinned by long-term take-or-pay contracts in its coal business, which are expected to be stable for the foreseeable future, and it's got growth upside tied to the Australian economy and the intermodal container and port services segments. It's also got a high-caliber customer base, which is made up of multinational miners, shipping lines, and freight forwarders. So this slide really just illustrates what I mean when I say Asciano is a game changer for our port and rail business. The acquisition is going to more than double both port and rail EBITDA, taking their combined business EBITDA to around $875 million. So now I want to share with you some of our strategy for how we are going to drive value in the combined business going forward. On the container port side of the business, we believe that the combined entity will have all of the required ingredients to build a truly global container terminal platform. And we think the first key ingredient to this is about leveraging our combined customer relationships. So if you have a look at the table there, you'll see that there's actually a very limited crossover between our customers and Asciano's customers, which is excellent. We're getting seven new customers as a result of this transaction that we didn't already have before. And post-transaction, hopefully we can leverage, some of those customers can go from one business into the other and be in both and have more crossover, or maybe, we've just got more customers we can work with on potential acquisitions or development opportunities that, may provide further capital investment opportunities for us in the future. The second key ingredient is about deploying our industry-leading technology to add value to new investments. So I already talked about the amazing technology in LA, but in Asciano and the Patrick business, they've actually been a pioneer in developing that AutoStrad technology. So what you see in the bottom right picture there, that's in-house designed and developed by Patrick. It's used now in our LA terminal already. They have no peer, really, when it comes to implementing this technology. They turned their Botany terminal from manual to automatic in 4 days, and no one else has ever done that, and we think it's going to be a serious advantage for us going forward in this platform. In terms of the two technologies, they're a little different, and it really comes down to density of the stockyard. In Patrick, they don't have stockyard capacity issues at this point in time, so it's really a low-density automation solution where you just use those auto strats to move the containers around. They can stack containers up to two high on their own. In LA, we need two different pieces of technology. We have the auto strats moving the containers around, then we have auto-stacking cranes because we need to be able to stack the containers up to five high to maximize that stockyard density. So on a combined basis, we believe that our expertise is unmatched and it's going to be a true differentiator for Brookfield when we're looking to build up this platform going forward. So we think the final ingredient to creating this global container terminal platform is having a true international market presence with boots on the ground in the regions where investments are being considered. So if you look at the chart here, we've now got over 140 investment professionals in 15 offices around the world. We've got people in every region actively searching for proprietary investment opportunities that are going to add value to our platform. And we've got the required access to capital to execute effectively. So now I just want to touch quickly on our investment thesis for the rail business of Asciano. There's really two key components to it, and it's pretty straightforward. The first is that, you know, this business is in a position right now where it's set to generate very high levels of cash flow due to the stability offered by those long-term take-or-pay contracts in the coal business, that leading intermodal rail franchise, and, you know, almost most importantly, this completion of a significant CapEx program, which is going to give us kind of low and stable CapEx in this business going forward. The second part of the thesis is it has great long-term growth potential. You know, while the Australian economy is looking like it's probably going to be a little soft in the near term, we think it still has very attractive long-term growth prospects. And Asciano in the rail business has a very, you know, largely fixed cost base. And so what that means is, you know, combining that with the surplus capacity, when the growth does come, it should come on a, you know, a highly cash generative basis. So we're well on our way to building a world-class port and rail transportation business. We're really excited about the future of this sector. Once we complete this acquisition, our business is going to have some amazing stats. It's going to have a combined port and rail EBITDA of around $875 million. It's going to have 10,000 kilometres of rail, 1,300 locomotives and 31,000 wagons. It's going to have operations at around 70 bulk and container terminals globally and two landlord ports. It's going to have market-leading positions in almost all the segments that it operates in, and state-of-the-art technology, which you know, we think is going to provide a competitive advantage going forward. So we think all of these amazing attributes combine to provide a really bright and, you know, really exciting future for this business. So that was everything I was planning to cover off today. As Sam mentioned, I'm happy to take a few questions now, or and take some more at the end if we need to.
Andrew Kutsky, Credit Suisse. Just a question on, assuming Asciano goes through and you're successful in acquiring the company, is the focus on the rail side of the business going to be more on network extensions, enhancements, more minor things, just to really drive incremental returns? Because if I think back to when you did WestNet Rail and the expansion there, the $600 million expansion, the returns were enormous off of that on really the multiple.
Yeah.
Is that going to be the focus in the near term and then infill acquisitions thereafter?
Yeah, look, I think that sort of stuff's obviously driven by the market. So I think our initial focus is going to be on efficiency and costs and sharing best practices between, you know, our different rail businesses. We think there's a lot of benefit to be had in our Brazilian rail business from taking, you know, what is a very sophisticated level of expertise from the Australian business and applying it over there. You know, we're definitely excited about getting close to, you know, a bunch more customers and more parts of the supply chain in Australia, and hopefully working with them, as you say, to do, you know, various projects to add value, you know, invest some capital and work with our customers. So it'll be all of those things. There are obviously some larger scale transactions that may come along in the rail space in Australia at some point in the future, and we'll keep an eye on those as well.
Hi, it's Sherilyn Radbourne from TD Securities. Just wondering if you could give us a sense as to how much volume exposure you've got in your existing port and rail business and how that changes post the Asciano deal.
Sure. So I would say that there is more, we'll probably have proportionally less volume exposure post the transaction, because there's a really big chunk of the Asciano business that is underpinned by these take-or-pay contracts. So it's probably about 40% of that business that's underpinned by take-or-pay contracts, whereas the existing business would have a lower level than that.
If you compare your rail and port business that you're building to the standard railroads here in North America, CNR, up in Canada, or the U.S. carriers, how would you compare your size vis-a-vis the ones that we know already?
It's a tough question for me because I'm Australian, so I'm not as familiar with those railroads. So I may have to let Sam come back and comment on that one later on, if that's okay. I think that's my three. So I'll introduce Marcos to come and talk about Brazil. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Stuart, and good morning, everyone. In my presentation, I'll basically focus on 2 points. One, I will describe the current economic and political scenario in Brazil. And then I will explain how we want that to play on our favor. There is no doubt that there is today a crisis of confidence in Brazil. The root of this crisis is the economic downturn, and this economic downturn is triggering a political crisis. But we have seen this movie before. We saw this movie back in 2009 in the United States, and we also saw this movie in 2012 and 2013 in Europe. At that time, we said that the long-term prospects of both the United States and Europe have not changed, and now we say that the long-term prospects of Brazil has not changed either. And if we believe in it, the conclusion that we reach is that today there is a unique opportunity to acquire premier assets for value in Brazil. It's an opportunity I've never seen before since I joined Brookfield back in 2003. Let's talk about the economic scenario. I would briefly describe that the economic downturn starts with the end of what we call the triple C growth cycle. And the triple C stands for commodity, credit, and consumption. After this triple C economic growth cycle ends, there is a devaluation of the currency. The devaluation of the currency triggers inflation. The government responds with an increase in interest rates that further impacts the economy. Nevertheless, Brazil is a low-cost producer in many key export markets. Just to name a few, Brazil is the biggest exporter of sugar, of soybeans, corn, coffee, beef, orange juice, and poultry. We believe that the currency adjustment will make the competitive position of Brazil even stronger, that exports will increase, and the increase in exports will then further and bring Brazil back to the growth cycle. And if I would summarize the political scenario, I think the economic downturn had a huge impact in the approval rate of our president, Dilma Rousseff. The approval rate plummeted to 7%. With the low approval rate, she lost support from the coalition. And without the support from coalition, it's getting very hard for her to govern the country. Nevertheless, Brazil today is completely different from Brazil 20 or 30 years ago. Brazil today is a middle-class country. And we are very confident that this middle class, different from our neighboring countries, do not believe that a solution will come through that the solution would come through some populist measures to solve the economic problem or even socialist measures. When we constantly talk about Brazilian economic downturn, we end up forgetting how big and how important the country is. The country is the fifth largest country by size and by population, and the seventh largest economy in the world. Just to put that into perspective, Brazilian economy is bigger than the Canadian economy. It's also bigger than the Russian economy or the Korean economy. In terms of size, we are bigger than U.S., excluding Alaska. And when we also talk about crises all the time, we end up forgetting that we have in Brazil strong institutions. We have a strong democracy. We have a strong judiciary system. We have a solid banking system, and we have a very favorable demography. So here we show that we have seen this movie before. If you take a look in terms of stock performance, GDP, and unemployment rates, The situation that we now see in Brazil is not much different from what we saw in U.S. In 2008 and 2009, or even in Spain recently. If we believe in the long-term prospects of the country, I would say that today the investment environment is better than ever, and especially in the infrastructure sector. And the reason for that is that the mining companies, the construction companies, and the state-owned companies are the ones that were hit the hardest by the current economic crisis. And those sectors are the ones that own the majority of the infrastructure assets in Brazil. Today in Brazil, there are more opportunities that we can handle. This gives us a unique opportunity to cherry pick the assets that we want. So what we are focused on? We are focused on multifaceted transactions where we can play a leading role, where we can be in the driving seat. And in the next pages, I will talk about Invepar, which is the third biggest, among the third biggest infra platforms, infrastructure platforms in Brazil. We also believe that this is the right time for us to expand our existing platforms. And we'll talk about our toll road portfolio and our rail portfolio in Brazil. And we also believe that the current economic downturn gives us the opportunity to come back to a sector that we invested in Brazil until 2009, which is the transmission sector. Let's talk about Invepar. Invepar is a portfolio of 12 concessions, and here you highlight two of them. One is the Guarulhos Airport. This is the biggest airport in Latin America. It has 40 million passengers. Just to put that into perspective, this airport is bigger than the Toronto Airport, the Sydney Airport, or the Miami Airport in the United States. This is an airport that has very diversified and resilient revenues, and we believe that we can buy it for that. The second opportunity is that we are pursuing is Metro Rio. Metro Rio is basically the whole metro system of Rio de Janeiro, which is among the top four cities in South America. It transports 200 million passengers per year. It's a very low-cost and efficient platform with significant opportunities for expansion. This metro system is also the third biggest metro system in the whole Latin America. Toll roads and rail. I think we believe that we have a unique opportunity today to privatize arteries, and we expect to complete it soon. We also believe that there is a significant opportunity to grow and expand arteries. The government recently announced a $60 billion program to invest in toll roads in Brazil. Of those $60 billion, $6 billion are in our toll roads that we will only invest if we end up reaching a mutually acceptable agreement with the government. And we believe that this is the right time. There are also significant opportunities to consolidate the market. The toll road market in Brazil is highly fragmented, and we believe that the scenario may change during the next couple of years. We also believe that there is potential to increase investments in our port through port expansions, new rail concessions, and also buying existing platforms. This could eventually generate opportunities to invest in VLI, to pursue those opportunities that could eventually give us the opportunity to increase our ownership in the company. As I have mentioned, we have invested in the transmission sector in Brazil. We sold an asset in 2009 for $270 million. which generated an IRR of 32% in U.S. dollars. After that, we haven't seen an opportunity to come back to the market due to the returns that we saw for those kinds of assets. And after almost 6 years, we believe that this is now the right time. We are pursuing a series of opportunities in the transmission sector. We don't know if they are going to materialize, but they involve existing platforms, they involve greenfield assets, and they also involve greenfield assets that are that will be completed in a couple of years. Just for you to have an idea of the Brazilian transmission grid, we have a total of 130, 140 kilometers of transmission lines in Brazil. This is probably 14 times the transmission grid in Chile, where we own Transelec. And the plan is to increase it by 70,000 kilometers during the next 10 years. 7,000 kilometers is, again, another 7 Transelecs. To conclude, I think probably all of you know the Warren Buffett's quote, but just probably only some of you know the Brazilian saying, which is in fact the saying from my region, Minas Gerais. At the end, the saying is all about patience and execution. We are not saying that Brazil will change tomorrow, that Brazil will change next year. We think that there is a long-term opportunity, and this is the right time. But it will take time. And in terms of execution, we are not going to jump into the middle of a hot soup. We are going to pursue assets for value. We are going to pursue assets below replacement costs. And we are going to pursue trophy assets that we believe that will increase value over time. I think with that, I finish my presentation and we'll open for questions.
How many folks are looking at a lot of large-scale infrastructure assets in Brazil, such as yourself? Like, how much capital is chasing those assets? And then how much have you changed your return expectations, if at all, for the economic outlook in Brazil now versus maybe a few years ago?
Yeah, in terms of the scenario that we see in Brazil is that, differently from the past, where we had lots of Brazilian competitors chasing for assets in Brazil, today we see none. We see some other investors trying to get into Brazil, but they will need to go through a learning curve. They are opening their offices right now. They are hiring people. We are in a completely different scenario than they are, that put us in a very competitive position to be the preferred buyer of many assets in Brazil. And the second question was? The return expectation. I think today in Brazil is a scenario, it's a buyer's market, and we have very motivated sellers. So we will take that into consideration when we make our offers. And as a consequence of that, I think the returns will be attractive than the ones that we have, more attractive than the ones that we have seen in the recent past.
Just when you look at your existing businesses, a lot of capital going into VLI and potentially into the toll road system, and then you've highlighted, obviously, specifically Invapar, but transmission and other toll road roll-ups. There's a lot of opportunities. You've talked about cherry-picking. You know, what's the long-term kind of view as to how much you want Brazil as part of the mix? But more specifically, with all these opportunities, how high would you be comfortable Brazil being in terms of current FFO, just given all of what sounds like very significant opportunities in front of you?
Yeah, I think we have significant opportunities in front of us, and some of them we are very confident despite the economic downturn. For example, in the case of VLI, the EBITDA that we expect to have in 2015 is going to be twice the one that we have in 2013. But I think at the end, our exposure to Brazil, and I think Sam can further explain on that, is going to be limited to what we have historically, to what we historically have.
But in the short term, can you see that being significantly higher, just given then the high returns and the great opportunity?
Yeah, I think there are some sizable platforms that we are looking at. We don't know if you're going to complete those deals. If we do, there could be significant investments in Brazil in the short run. But it depends on how successful we are in our transactions.
And on top of Invepar? Invepar plus some other potential sizable acquisitions?
Yeah, there could be, yes.
Thank you.
David knows what he's CIBC. A quick question in terms of understanding that you're not sure when exactly things will turn around in Brazil, but can you comment on what's going to trigger that turnaround in your expectation and why you're looking to buy now?
Yeah, I think what is going to trigger is, I think differently from some European countries, that it took longer because they could not play the currency game to come back quicker to the growth path. I think that in Brazil is different. And we believe that the devaluation of the currency will make the industry to come back, and will also have a significant impact in our exports. And this will bring the country back to growth. And we also have a big internal market with 204 million people. When this will happen is difficult to say. But I think that we have seen this happening before in Brazil, and we believe that this will happen in Brazil over time.
Just a follow-on to Robert's question in terms of capital allocation, how do you think about your risk-adjusted returns for Brazil relative to your opportunities in your other jurisdictions? Admittedly, returns are higher, but I would think that risks might also be.
Yeah, the risks are also higher, but we will be very careful in our projections. And also we believe that this is, again, the right time to buy. I think one thing is to buy assets when everybody is buying it. And today is a completely different market. There are lots of situations that we are the only buyer, and we have very motivated sellers. We believe that this put us in a strong position to buy assets for value. And the right moment for us is when we do the acquisition and when we decide the price that we are going to pay for this asset. And I have never seen a better moment like this in Brazil before. Well, with that, I will pass it over to Bahia.
Thank you, Marcos, and good morning, everyone. So as we've seen, Stuart really gets excited about robots. Marcos is really excited about Brazil, but what gets me excited the most is our balance sheet, foreign exchange, and interest rates. So hopefully some of you out there share with me this excitement and find this presentation interesting. So just given the volatility in the markets these days, we thought we'd spend some time on just a few issues that are top of mind to most investors out there. We'll address these by giving just everyone a refresher on our general approach to capital management in this business, touch a bit on our credit profile, and really take you through the state of our balance sheet today, which has never been stronger. And then I want to also come back to two themes that are top of mind, as I said, to a lot of people, which is how does rising rates impact our business and how we deal with foreign exchange volatility. So with that as an intro, I'll kick it off and just again go through our guiding principles or our approach to capital management. And really there's five key anchors to this that has served us really well since our inception. So the first is we finance our business primarily at the asset level and on a non-recourse basis back to Brookfield Infrastructure partners. We think this is a lower risk capital structure or approach, and much more so that one than one that has debt cross collateralized amongst the various businesses. Today, our corporate debt represents less than 10% of our total debt in the business. This is a guideline that we've stuck to now for a while, and one that we'll continue to stick to for the long term. Corporate debt is not really a meaningful source of funding for our business. Rather, it's really supplementary in nature to our overall capital stack. From time to time, we opportunistically access the corporate credit markets to again, supplement our overall liquidity position, but we're not overly reliant on it. The second principle that we stick to in this business is that we structure our debt on an investment-grade basis. We think this is prudent as it ensures that we're not overstretched. Today, over 90% of our total debt in our core businesses is investment-grade rated, with the majority of our businesses having triple B mid ratings or higher. We also look to match currencies to underlying asset cash flows and fix rates across our business. This is important as it serves as a natural hedge to the various currencies that we're exposed to, and it also insulates us from fears of rising rates, which I'll touch on later on in the presentation. Today, over 95% of our debt has been raised in local currencies, and over 85% of our long-term debt's been fixed. So we're in pretty good shape in both of those. Fourth, we put on long-duration debt. We strive to keep a well-laddered maturity profile, and we try to limit the financial maintenance covenants in our debt packages. I think it's self-explanatory why this is important for the size of the business and scale that we have today, and one that continues to grow and expand in the future. Today, our average duration in the business is over 10 years, and we have no material maturities coming up in the next 2 years as a result of all the work that we've been doing over the last couple of years, really capitalizing on this historically low-rate interest environment. And just lastly, we access capital through multiple sources in multiple sectors and regions. This is important as it allows us to pull capital from various regions, markets, or institutions, and really ensures that we're not impacted by any liquidity issues that are dealt in any specific market or region that's out there. So today, 45% of our debt is in the private placement market in the hands of over 100 investors. 35% is in the capital markets in multiple geographies, including the U.S., Canada, Australia, and Brazil. And 20% of our debt is in the bank markets, placed with over 35 institutions around the globe. So in the next couple of slides, I want to just again take you through our credit story at the Brookfield Infrastructure Partner level or corporate entity, and really hone in on six measures that underpin our triple B plus stable rating at the corporate level. The first is we've got robust corporate coverage ratios, and this is primarily the result of having a modest amount of debt at the corporate level, in addition to having very stable predictable and growing cash flows, cash flow streams from the majority of our businesses that are distributed up to the corporate level. So this results in an interest coverage ratio today that exceeds 20 times, and which has been consistent at these levels for the last couple of years. I touched on this before, but we also have a well-laddered debt maturity profile. Our maturities for the next 2 years are very modest. The big chunk of the 2017 maturity there that you see of the $1.3 billion relates to our North American natural gas transmission business that Sam alluded to earlier as the asset that's undergoing a strategic review as we speak. So if you strip that away, really what you'll have is over the next 5 years, we've got less than 20% of our debt that's maturing, and it's pretty laddered in from for those 5 years. We've got stable cash flow streams. Our utilities and Australian railroad businesses are the key anchors of our cash flows that are distributed today to the corporate entity. 85% of the cash flow streams from these businesses have no volume risk associated with them due to their regulated or take-or-pay contractual nature. We've got good diversification by sector and region and scale in premier markets around the world, and Sam will come back and speak to our diversification later on in his section. Our liquidity position is very strong. We've demonstrated an ability to access the capital markets at various points in the cycle. We've raised almost $3.5 billion of equity in the past since our inception, and our committed corporate credit facility today sits at $1.4 billion, which extends to 2020. And just lastly, we're proactive in how we manage currency exposures, and I'll come back to this later on in this section. So in summary, our BBB plus rating is very important to us, and it is our goal and intention to maintain this rating for the long term. I also wanted to touch on our consolidated metrics because quite often they could be misleading. What they are is just the result of many businesses that are being financed at the asset level, predominantly on an investment-grade basis. So these metrics really just depend on the composition of our businesses that we own in the portfolio at each point in time. When trying to understand what they mean, it's really important to peel the onion back, so to speak, and really look at the various components that make up this number. For instance, our utilities platform today, which is a meaningful part of our business, are typically financed with higher leverage levels than our other platforms as a result of implied capital structures that our regulators allow us to maintain, in addition to the fact that these businesses have very secure and predictable cash flows. So these assets today are typically financed with 60 to 70% debt to capitalization, or approximately 5.5 to 6 times debt to EBITDA. However, when you look at our other platforms, being our transportation, energy, and communication infrastructure, they're typically financed with much lesser leverage levels. And today, on a weighted average basis for these three segments, our debt to EBITDA is less than 4 times and stands today at 3.8 times. I should mention here, though, before moving on, that we've excluded the impact of NGPL from the energy numbers just because that asset's just going through a strategic review, as we alluded to earlier. That being said, our consolidated metrics are actually getting better with time. Back in 2011, 2012, they were at 6 times. They've improved to 5.3. Which is the current run rate. Once we close the Asciano deal, looking forward to 2016, we'd expect them to come down to five times. And our target in the next 3 to 4 years, just with all the growth prospects we have for this business, is to get that metric down to 4.5. So moving on, I wanted to hit on a very important theme, which is the impact of rising rates and what that means to our business. You know, we all see headlines each day about potentially what the Fed's going to do or not do, pace and quantum of various increases. and all kinds of speculation that has to do with this. But what does that really mean for our business? First off, I would say there's a general misconception out there that rising rates are negative for infrastructure assets like ourselves. On the one hand, we see the similarities between infrastructure assets and bonds and how they behave. Infrastructure businesses have strong barriers to entry that provide very stable cash flows, very similar to high-grade long-term bonds. However, our business is relatively insulated from rising rates for two key reasons. The first, and as I alluded to earlier, our debt is predominantly fixed. Second, almost 85% of our EBITDA grows with inflation and or surplus capacity. Rising rates are generally indicative of growth in economies and higher inflation. Today, 70 to 75% of our EBITDA is indexed to inflation through the various regulatory frameworks we operate within or through long-term contracts we have with solid counterparties. In addition to surplus capacity that we have predominantly in our transport business, that stands to benefit with GDP growth over time. So to fully understand the impact of rising rates in our business, we'll walk you through what this means from a cost of debt perspective for the debt that's coming due in the next little while. And as well, we'll look at the valuation of our businesses today that don't stand to benefit from inflation and surplus capacity. So let's go through now the impact on our debt. And so before I illustrate this, it's important to first understand the overall profile of our debt stack. Our business is diversified, and so is the debt associated with it, as we predominantly finance everything, as I said, at the asset level in many different jurisdictions and in local currencies. And so in order to quantify the impact of rising rates, it's crucial to first assess two key things. First, where is the debt originated? Because not every region today is at the same point in their economic cycle. And for those regions that are susceptible to increases in rates, how much debt is actually maturing over the next little while? But to answer the first question, and as you can see from this slide, approximately 50% of our debt is located in or raised in the North American market or in the UK and Europe. And we think for these regions, you probably will see a rate hike at some point. I don't know when, but at some point in the next little while. And then for regions such as South America, you probably will see rates there decreasing in the short to medium term. So now that we've figured out the percentage of our debt in the business that's susceptible to potential rate hikes, we see here that only 14% of our debt in the North American market is coming due in the next 5 years, and only 6% of our debt in Europe is maturing in the same time frame. We picked 5 years just because it coincides with how we do business planning in our business, and we thought it was an appropriate period of time to use. So to show you the impact of rising rates on our overall cost of debt, we walked through just a quick example here. First, we calculated the amount of interest expense in the regions that are susceptible to these rate hikes. And we get that just from annualizing the first 6 months of 2015. We then quantified the impact of rising rates on our debt that's coming due in the next 5 years, assuming that rates increase by 1, 2, or 3%. And then we calculated the present value of this impact and presented it as a percentage of our total FFO. And so as you can see from the net result here, an increase of rates by either 1 to 2 or 3% will not overly be meaningful to our business from an overall FFO perspective. In addition to increased interest expense, rising rates will also impact, as I mentioned, the valuation of our bond-like cash flow streams. We define bond-like cash flow streams as those that, again, don't benefit from inflation or surplus capacity. Today, about 16% of our business fits into this category, and they're predominantly utility businesses. These businesses today currently generate $135 million of FFO that we acknowledge could be impacted in a rising rate environment from a valuations perspective. Similar to the previous example, we tried to quantify in the table below here what that would mean from a present value perspective to our business. And then we compared, and again, we assumed that rates would increase 1 to 2 and 3%, and we raised the discount rates that you use to value these businesses. We then compared the impact of this to our total FFO. And while it changes in valuations don't really impact your FFO, we just thought it's a measure to just give you context here. You could probably use different metrics as well, but we picked FFO just given its importance to us from a metric perspective. So similar to the last example that I showed, the net result is insignificant by any standard. So an increase in rates by 1 or 2 or 3% should lead to only a decrease overall in our valuation of our total business by 0.4 to 1.2%. So hopefully these two scenarios that I walked you through showcase how relatively insignificant rising rates are to our business. Before moving on, though, there's an item that we ignored from this analysis that's quite important, and we just did that to keep the analysis clean and simple. But our utility businesses are subject to regular rate resets. And so, therefore, it's only a matter of time that these businesses will have their earnings reset and adjusted, as rising rates will enhance the returns that we earn on our rate base for these businesses, which should increase earnings going forward. So just the last section here, and it's to deal with foreign exchange. First and foremost, it's important to note that we invest in countries that have favorable long-term prospects. Currencies will go up, they'll go down. But generally, over the long term, this should normalize to reflect the country's long-term growth potential. Today, approximately 20% of our FFO is in U.S. dollars, and 80% is in foreign currencies, and that includes the Australian dollar, the pound, the euro, Canadian dollar, Brazilian real, and Chilean peso. To mitigate, though, the volatility in foreign exchange as much as possible in our business, we utilize the following approach. First, and I noted this earlier, we finance mostly all our debt in local currencies. Based on our overall debt to cap in this business today, that eliminates 45 to 50% of our exposure right out of the gate. Second, we predominantly hedge out the majority of our cash flows generated in foreign currencies for a period of 18 to 24 months. And this is really aimed to mitigate as much as possible the risk of short-term volatilities in our results by giving good visibility of the various cash flow streams that the business stands to generate in the short term. And then third, we retain or reinvest locally generated cash flows into our businesses in local currencies. Each year, we retain about 20 to 25% of our free cash flow, and we reinvest that back in our various businesses where we're able to compound and grow the values of these businesses for the long term. One of the most common questions we get is what happens to your results once your hedges roll off, and what happens if the Brazilian real continues to depreciate. So to illustrate this, we thought we'd just put a case study together that we thought is pretty conservative, and to walk you through what this all means for a dynamic business like ours today. First, we assumed that for the next couple of years, we'd invest about $500 million into new investments, and so this is in 2017 and 2018, and we'd earn a going-in FFO yield of 10%. This is conservative because we've actually averaged about $1 billion a year in the past since our inception, and we've typically financed a lot of this M&A in the past through asset sale proceeds. But for the purpose of this investment, we've assumed that we'd raise equity to fund this these new investments. We've also assumed that the base business grows on a same-store basis by 7.5%. Sam touched on this earlier. We've actually enjoyed about 13% average growth in the business since 2009. And even in 2015, we've done 11% same-store growth in the first half of the year, and we expect to be at that level for the second half as well. So we thought 7.5% is conservative. We assume that the Brazilian real declines by a further 25% in 2016, and that's from today's current levels, and also another 10% in 2017, and another 10% in 2018. We've also assumed that our hedge currencies don't improve from today's levels. And following our 11 to 13% distribution increase in 2016, what we've put into this analysis is that we'll grow our distribution by 9% in 2016 and 2017, which is at the top end of our long-term range. So I know that was all a mouthful, but the result here on the slide, and again, I'll do my best to just touch on the key points. What we used for 2015 as the anchor number here is just our annualized 6 months results, and so that's the 828. We've then factored in all the announced transactions that are out there and assumed that they all close at January 1st, 2016. And so rolling forward the results to 2017, and really here, why we've reflected those 2 years is the fact that these are the 2 years that we'll see all our hedges roll off. And so we ran through the impact of new investments, base business growth, reflected what the impact is from hedges rolling off, assuming no improvement in currencies, and what the Brazilian real depreciation means as well for our results. And so hopefully what you'll see here from an FFO payout ratio and an AFFO payout ratio is that they continue to be manageable. And even though they're slightly higher than our top end of our long-term targets, they're manageable, and they wouldn't stress us out on how we manage this business going forward. And so finally, before I hand the podium over to Sam, I'd like to summarize by saying in periods of capital market dislocations, Brookfield Infrastructure should perform well because of the strength of our balance sheet and the fact that our cash flows are relatively insulated from macroeconomic headwinds. Thank you very much for your time this morning. I'd be pleased to take a few questions. Andrew?
Andrew Kusky, Credit Suisse. But here, just maybe a point of clarification. So the guidance for the distribution growth in 16 of 11 to 13%, that's pretty clear. So the 9% that you're talking about for 17 and 18, that's really just illustrative under the situations you've got as opposed to actual guidance.
That's exactly right. This is just an example, and it really doesn't mean anything. So.
Okay, it's just... As Brian said yesterday, it's just math.
It's just mathematics.
Okay, so...
And I should note that we don't expect the Brazilian real to get to these levels, but again, it's just illustrative.
Okay, so just on the math point again, what cost savings do you have baked into your numbers at all on the illustration looking out? Is there anything significant on the cost savings?
cost savings with respect to
from an operational standpoint, so whether it's Asciano or anything else, so there's nothing significant.
The cost savings related to Asciano will come in through the accretion
mm-hmm.
that or the guidance that we've given out as part of that our materials with respect to that transaction, and in the rest of the business we've just factored in some pretty ordinary GDP and inflation growth predominantly.
So then maybe the final takeaway is it looks like double-digit distribution growth looks pretty reasonable for the next few years. I know you're looking at Sam right now.
I'm not. we'll study those at the right time, Andrew, and it's based on business conditions at the time.
Okay, thank you.
Bert?
Yeah, good morning, Bahir. Just a quick question in terms of country concentration parameters. Are they limiting you in any way in terms of accessing capital or having capital provided to you by the private Brookfield LP funds?
No, not really, Bert. I would say the business today is pretty diversified. Our exposure to South America is about 15 to 20%. And we've been generally very successful accessing capital from, as I mentioned, multiple sectors and multiple markets and institutions. So I wouldn't say we're impacted.
Okay. And just in terms of liquidity, when you went through the Asciano transaction, you went through kind of source and application of funds. But in addition to that, you have a pretty robust, organic growth initiatives internally, and then there's other capital opportunities. Can you talk about, that kind of balanced out? Can you talk about how you're thinking about other sources of capital you need to fund the opportunities that seem to be before you today?
So for all the transactions that we've announced and we have in front of us, I think we've got $3 billion of liquidity today, and that should suffice in funding all of that. We've got a $1.4 billion organic CapEx backlog. We'll raise asset-level debt to fund a good portion of that, and the equity component that we need to fund generally just comes from retained cash flows in the business. And, with respect to other transactions, I would say today we're not we're focused on dealing with all the transactions that are in front of us, which would be Asciano, Invapar, closing out NISCA, and privatizing our Brazilian toll road business. And so I think from a liquidity position, we're in good shape. And as Sam mentioned earlier, we're going to be really focused on selling assets in 2016, and that should be a supplementary way of how we fund things going forward.
Okay, thanks.
Brendan?
Thanks. So I had two questions. So one, I think it was mentioned yesterday in the BAM presentation that they felt like some of the foreign currencies were bottoming relative to the U.S. dollar, and maybe at least at the BAM level they were going to roll some of those hedges off or reduce some of their hedge exposure. So are you guys planning on doing that as well, or do you feel like you'll still do the 18 to 24-month kind of hedge on a forward basis? And then I had a follow-up on same store, but if you want to answer that one first.
Sure. So we'll study it at the time, but we're generally pretty coordinated amongst the various BAM groups. I think the one currency probably they were hitting on is probably the Australian dollar, which we believe has bottomed out or has reached near bottom levels. Look, we've got hedges on till late 2016 from an FFO perspective. We might lighten up on our net investment hedges, and I think that's what Bruce was touching on, but from an FFO perspective, we intend to keep all those hedges on. Now, after we buy Asciano, we'll make the call whether or not we'll hedge out their FFO going forward, and it all depends on our entry point and what our view is at the time.
And then just follow up on the same store. So 11% done this year. You've got 7.5% in sort of the projections. I've always felt like your businesses from a core growth perspective kind of mirrored GDP, and I think your same store is a levered number. So maybe that means on a levered basis it's 5 or 6% versus 7.5% going forward. Are you including the growth CapEx projects into that same store number, or is it on a kind of constant asset investment basis?
No, we include the growth CapEx, and the reason we do that, Brendan, is because we can fund all of that through internally generated cash flow. So we don't have to access fresh new capital to fund that CapEx, and generally these projects are replenishing, or that backlog replenishes over time. So the three components or the building blocks are inflation, indexation, surplus capacity, which is really just GDP growth, and then the organic CapEx side of things.
Hi, it's Sherilyn Radborn from TD Securities. I just had a quick one on the comments you made earlier about debt to EBITDA coming down to a range of 4.5 to 5 times over time. Is that as the earnings ramp up post your growth projects in the transportation segment, or is that because you're looking to reduce debt?
No, that's just a function of earnings stepping up in our various businesses, utilities, transport, communication infrastructure, and the likes. So I think that's the time I have, and so I'll pass it off to Sam now.
Thanks, Bahir, and I can assure everyone now that the math class is over, and we're going to just step it up a little bit, and I'm going to try and pull together the various presentations and just deal with a few things from a strategic level. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about just our diversification strategy and just our approach to building value, and again, as I said, touching on the themes that you've heard earlier today. We often get asked about where we're taking the business. And over our 7-year history, you know, we've had a set of strategic goals that really hasn't changed at all and have been fairly straightforward. And we really intend to continue along the same path. And we've got them on the page here, which is, you know, effectively just to create a portfolio that's diversified by sector, geography, to own high-quality assets with strong organic growth potential, and to deliver growing and stable distributions for our unit holders. And the way we do that, you know, again, and you've heard this, you know, yesterday, you hear it again today, is by value investing and building on our platforms. And when we refer to value investing, we're generally describing investments when we move into new sectors and geographies. And when we enter new sectors and geographies, we're always seeking to identify either contrarian investment themes, or we've commonly phrased these multifaceted transactions. And really what we're trying to do is, in each case, you know, buy a business at a discount to its intrinsic value. When we have an existing platform, you know, we're always seeking to identify organic growth opportunities or tuck-in acquisitions within the business. And as you've probably heard me say many times before, we always feel that those are our best risk-adjusted returns that we can make in our business. And the reason for that is when we pursue those type of opportunities, there's usually little or very modest competition for those opportunities, because we have a franchise area where others just can't either pursue it or don't have the same competitive advantages we have. Often we have a much better understanding of all the operating risks involved, so we can price that into a situation. And usually we have synergies that we can utilize to enhance our returns. So those are always the best opportunities. We thought that, you know, one of the things we'd do to best illustrate, you know, where we're going is to kind of look backwards and see where we come from. And so I look around the room today, and I can see a lot of familiar faces. And I know many of you were probably in the room. We didn't have an investor day back then for a bit, but we had it for BAM, and many of you recall our humble beginnings. You know, we started the company with, I guess back in 2008, with two core business units, our utilities and timber business. We operated five assets across two geographies, North and South America. And our investment professionals operated really out of only four offices. We had one in Toronto, New York, Vancouver, and Sao Paulo. And the scale of the business was much, much smaller. We had a market cap of about $500 million, and our distribution per units per unit was about $1.06. So if you fast forward 2 years, and we complete our first transformational acquisition, and that was the investment in Babcock & Brown infrastructure. And that was a great transaction for two reasons. One was we got some great assets, but we also got some great people. And you met one of them today, Stuart Upson, came with that transaction, and he's now one of the leaders of our business. In preparation for that transaction, we sold an asset that Mark was described. We sold our Brazilian transmission business for about $270 million. That gave us some of the capital we used for that acquisition. And with BBI, we began working on that transaction back in the spring of 2009. And as you can recall, that was a pretty dark period of time for most of us. Things were pretty pessimistic. And it's very safe to say that that acquisition was not only multifaceted, but was very contrarian. BBI brought us 11 different businesses and in three different continents. It had assets in Australia, Europe, and North America. And by the end of 2010, our market cap had grown to about $3.5 billion. And just after 2010 and in 2011, we increased our distributions from $1.10 to $1.32 as a result of that transaction. So that was a big leap forward for us. The following 2 to 3 years marked another phase in our evolution. We identified an opportunity to effectively reposition the company, and we got ourselves out of some lower growth, lower yielding assets and invest into higher growth, higher earning businesses. And examples of that, we sold our Australian distribution business and our timber platform for about $1.5 billion of net proceeds. And we redeployed those proceeds into a number of assets. Some of the notable transactions you might recall, the $600 million expansion of our Australian railroad. We acquired Nexus, a UK distribution business, which we merged with our GTC distribution business to form what's today called Brookfield Utilities UK. We established our toll road platform in South America. And we acquired our first district energy business called Enwave in Toronto, and that was the first of many district energy businesses that we've acquired since. And the market capitalization at that time grew to about $6 billion, and we've increased our distributions to $1.50. So then again, fast forwarding to today. We've added California container terminals, Brazilian railroad that you've heard about today, communications infrastructure business called TDF, and then we have three transactions pending, the most significant of which is the one Stuart described, which is Asciano. And if you pro forma all those transactions, we've got an unbelievable portfolio of high-quality assets diversified across five continents, four different segments, and 30 businesses. And virtually all these businesses have tremendous growth potential. And so, we're pretty excited by, where we're starting from. And if you, getting back to my, initial question that I was trying to answer, which is, where are we going or how are we going to get there? We're basically going to follow the exact same roadmap, which is building on our platforms and buying in new geographies and sectors on a value basis. So I'm just going to summarize some of the things. And I know you've heard about a few of these today, but then just to make sure it's all on one page as to how we're going to grow the business in those two manners. So on the building up platform side, we really see four areas of businesses and sectors where we want to focus on. The first one is globalizing our port business. This is really leveraging the Asciano transaction and the TradePAC business and following our customers and technology and our international reach, and we see great opportunities to do that. You know, we're looking to add to our toll road footprint, not only in South America, but we're looking at opportunities in India, which we've just recently announced a transaction, and also in Europe. We'll continue to, you know, to focus on our district energy rollout, we've done over the last 3 years, I think we've made 7 acquisitions in that area. We've got businesses in Chicago, Houston, New Orleans, Las Vegas, Toronto, Seattle. It's been an unbelievable opportunity for us. We see, you know, many other opportunities to add to that business in North America. It's highly fragmented. In addition to that, you know, we've been expanding systems and acquiring systems in Australia. We're looking at opportunities in the UK, and we're now seeing a few interesting business opportunities in that sector in Europe as well. So that's a great business for us to focus on. And then I guess the last one was just the transmission sector. This is obviously one that in the past has been pretty competitive, but similar to the way we've been successful in growing and building out our Texas transmission system by being selected as a developer, we see a number of those opportunities available in the United States that we're pursuing, and we're looking to build a business in Brazil, which, you know, is a place, as Marcos described, we had a business in the past, and we think now is the time to reenter that that business and see if we can to rebuild it. Then on the value investing side, you know, we've touched on a couple of themes. I'm not going to repeat the opportunities in Brazil, but obviously this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for us to invest in that country. Energy infrastructure is something that I think I've been getting a lot of questions about. You know, probably the main reason is as most of the people in this room will have known, I imagine there's lots of MLP investors here. The index is off probably 35% year over year. It's off 25% plus or minus year to date. You know, we think that with you know, the re-rating of those stocks, you know, obviously there's some that are probably still overvalued, but there's many good companies that have gone down with the tide, and you know, we think there could be great opportunities to look at that sector. In addition, many of the E&P companies that obviously have to deleverage themselves with a whole new commodity environment, we expect they will look to exit some of their owned infrastructure, and we'll be pursuing those opportunities as well. And lastly, on the distressed investing side, and I don't like using that word distressed, but you know, today there are a number of sectors that we see with companies that are in challenging financial circumstances. Probably the three areas, you know, that we are focused on, one would be the energy utility companies in Europe. They still have very challenged balance sheets. They need to sell assets, and they're trying to comply with lots of new regulations in that part of the world. The mining companies are obviously in difficulty, and we're seeing lots of major companies looking to sell off infrastructure that never would have dreamed of selling off in the past. And then what hasn't changed is all the construction companies are still reeling, many of them European, lots of them in South America. And again, they're owners of high-quality assets, and we think they're going to be selling assets over the next couple of years as well. So, you know, the next couple of slides, I'm just going to briefly touch on a few initiatives that we're focused on to achieve our investment and objectives. And I'd say the first one is that we believe over the next 5 to 10 years, we should and will develop a meaningful presence in Asia. This is a market that has about 60% of the world's population and over 30% of the world's GDP, and that continues to grow. To do that, you know, we've opened offices in Mumbai and Shanghai. And, you know, one of the things that we're able to do, and I know this came up yesterday, just the relationship with Brookfield and the broader Brookfield family, From an infrastructure perspective, it really makes our lives a lot easier when we can leverage the broader Brookfield business and just the experience and the people they have in the ground in markets where we're looking to go in. And so in the case of India and China, the real estate business and other parts of the Brookfield organization have been there for many years, and we're leveraging those local contacts and experience in building out our franchise and those markets. So that's a huge help for us. In North America, you know, we see a number of opportunities in the port, district energy, and energy infrastructure sectors. And so we're looking to meaningfully increase our exposure in this market. We've probably reduced it with a number of the acquisitions, particularly Asciano will provide more Australian exposure to our business. But we think that there are a tremendous number of opportunities in North America, and so you'll see the amount of investments we have in this market probably grow over the next couple of years. And to do that, you know, we've been expanding our presence in this market as well. We've expanded our complement of people in Houston, and we just recently opened an office in Mexico City. And then last area I want to touch on was just, you know, from a sector perspective. Obviously, we've got a diversified business, but there's two sectors that we have been looking to enter over the last couple of years. That's the airport sector and the water sector. We believe both sectors have very attractive investment characteristics. Generally, entry points into those sectors can be challenging, but today we've got a couple initiatives underway where I think we have a good shot of getting into them on a value basis. Marcos touched on Guarulhos Airport in Invapar, and that's obviously would be an unbelievable chip for us to use to grow further into that sector. And in the water business, we've been looking at many opportunities around the world, and we've got one that we're pursuing now that we're hopeful will get us there in a meaningful way. So I'm going to conclude with just a couple of comments here. You know, I think that, and I realize this is a bit self-serving, but Brookfield Infrastructure should be a core holding for any investors, and really across any business cycle. I think at times, I know today, you know, we had Bahir come up and rather than, you know, draw, you know, a chart to the ceiling of how much our stock could go up, he really focused on, you know, really what could go wrong. And, you know, we did that, I guess, to make a point that, you know, for, you know, periods of time, and today it's a bit of a volatile period in the markets, you know, Brookfield Infrastructure is an unbelievably defensive stock, and for those investors looking for a defensive stock, we think you should strongly consider it. And it's because we have this tremendous diversity across regions and sectors, which gives us great predictable and stable cash flows, which I think everyone is seeking. In addition to that, our diversity also helps us in deploying capital, because we can increase the investable universe and put our capital in those markets where we see good value and at the best risk-adjusted returns. But then we're not just a good defensive stock. You know, we think that our platforms give us a unique opportunity to generate growth and to have a total return that is, you know, really attractive for our investors on a long-term basis. And I think you've seen that with our distribution growth and what we've been able to achieve over the last 7 to 8 years. And, you know, with the successful closing of Asciano, and we're hoping we can get that over the line in the next month or two, as well as a number of acquisitions that we've already announced, we anticipate very strong growth in 2016. And, Andrew, I think it was your question, we are reiterating our distribution guidance for 2016 of 11 to 13% for that year. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Uh, Good morning.
Frederick Bastien from Raymond James. Sam, you started out as owner of discrete assets, but now you have the scale to start approaching things a bit differently. You're targeting a more integrated approach with your rail and ports business, and it's easy to see how you're going to be able to extract synergies because of the customer base is global. What other sectors could offer BIP similar opportunities globally?
So, Frederick, where are you? Okay, there you are. Sorry. The question was, what other sectors can we
approach? The market on a more integrated basis. I mean, you're approaching that on the ports and the rail business. Your customer base is global, but as you look at other sectors, whether their customer base could pretend for a similar approach.
Probably the area where it may be a bit different, but you know, we've always thought that the mining sector was an area where there are multiple different types of infrastructure assets that we could approach them and help them solve some of their balance sheet issues. And it's really around following them to different parts of the world and leveraging that relationship. It's a little bit different than the container port concept of finding customers where we can leverage them into multiple ports. I'd say the other area where we could consider that. Is probably most of them. I'm trying to think of another good example. That's probably the best one. It's probably our mining customers that I can think of off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Good morning, Sam. Throughout the presentation this morning, I get the sense that your Asciano purchase might be funded internally, asset sales, and the previous BAM equity commitment. Am I wrong, or are you still forecasting a share issue? Thank you.
So we're fully funded for the acquisitions that we have. We're not looking to raise any equity anytime soon. As part of the Asciano acquisition, part of the purchase is being paid for with units of Brookfield Infrastructure Partners. So there will be new units to the extent that transaction closes. But other than that, we pre-funded the acquisition back last April, and our liquidity is sufficient to meet all our obligations in the foreseeable future. Bert?
Sitting in the middle wasn't a good strategy. In terms of water, can you just give us a sense of the kinds of assets? I know you've got a transaction that you're currently engaged on, but can you give us a sense of the kinds of assets that you're looking at that would build out that platform?
Sure. We've been looking and trying to acquire assets in the water sector for a number of years now. They've generally been, regulated water systems, either in the UK, Spain, and in Chile. Those are, the three main areas we focused on. There were a few smaller acquisitions that we looked at in the United States, again, regulated utilities. But more recently, our focus has been on desalination businesses. And these are, it's a bit more of a development business. But once you've built the facilities, they're fully contracted to the local water utilities and effectively provide very long-term stable cash flows. So I'd say that's our focus today is on the desalination side. We're going to continue to look at regulated water utilities around the world, and we've seen a number of ones that come up for sale recently. And then I guess the only other thing that we do have a little bit of and we've been monitoring has been on the water recycling side. you know, this is a small little business that we have in Australia, and we've been seeing whether or not we can, you know, take that business model and apply it elsewhere in the world. So it's sort of three different angles.
Okay, thanks. And just in terms of Asciano, I'm assuming that you've spent some time in Australia talking to Asciano shareholders about BIP units. I wonder if you could just give us some color in terms of, you know, what those potential investors are thinking, what they're saying, just any kind of color or feedback, and then any update in terms of, you know, any regulatory processes that are underway, how those are going.
Okay, I'll deal with the regulatory question first, and I'll come back to the shareholders. You know, the two main regulatory conditions that we have remaining would be FIRB, which is Foreign Investment Review, I think on that one we feel fairly comfortable given our presence in Australia. In fact, we've been there for a long time. We've gotten FIRB approval for many assets before, but obviously, you know, this is a much larger transaction, and so there is a little bit more of a political sensitivity. From an ACCC perspective, that's the competition review. You know, we're just in the midst of it today. It's a little bit harder, you know, to predict exactly how, you know, that organization, you know, will respond. We don't believe that. I never felt that we had any competitive issues, given the various businesses and the fact that there's other businesses in Australia with a similar above and below rail composition. But, you know, we're in the process of having those discussions with them, and we're hopeful we'll get that done by the time the vote takes place in November. Now, as far as the shareholders of Asciano, you know, we've, to be frank, we've received lots of conflicting messages. You know, on the one hand, you know, as owners of Asciano, they wish they could get more at a higher price. But you know, we've always felt and convinced them. I think we've done a good job of convincing them that we put a fair price on the table. You know, the issue I think with them is twofold. One, you know, they struggle with the fact that there's fewer and fewer infrastructure companies in Australia, and so they are happy that we intend to list in the country, and that they'll have an opportunity to participate in a company that will have a meaningful Australian investment. But at the same time, they don't particularly like our business model. You know, they've, for whatever reason, you know, don't have an appreciation for the MLP sector. They had their own experience with some Macquarie and Babcock structures in the past, and so, you know, we've just been in the process of educating them on the way we're set up and the strong alignment of interest between Brookfield Asset Management and the unit holders of BIP. And I think we've had some good success, but we still got a lot of work to do. Bahir's been over there twice. I've done a number of meetings with them, and I intend to go back. And I think this will be just a long-term effort to educate them and hopefully get them excited about being investors in our company. For us, it's actually a very important initiative to access a new pool of capital and a new set of investors. One of the great things about the Australian market is that they are very knowledgeable infrastructure investors, and they like the asset class a lot. So it's really just a matter of getting them knowledgeable about our assets, and I'm highly confident once they see our assets, they're going to love the business. And then hopefully we can get them comfortable with the structure.
Thanks, Sam.
Any other questions? If not, that's great. Thank you very much, everyone. And so we'll take a 15-minute break. We're exactly on time. And then we'll go to Brookfield Renewable. Thank you.